It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Milwaukee residents helped choose a new design for their city flag over 2 years ago, but now the City Arts Board is asking for a new design contest. We'll get the latest on that and ask what you think a flag for your community should look like. First, hundreds of migrants looking to live in the United States clashed with Mexican and American security agents yesterday at the U.S.-Mexico border. They're part of a larger group of thousands of migrants who traveled together toward the United States from Central America. Their arrival comes as President Trump is trying to limit some of their ability to apply for asylum. Alan Gomez is a reporter who covers immigration in Latin America at USA Today. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we have these dramatic videos and images in the news of rocks being thrown, tear gas at the border. Can you break down for us kind of step by step what's happened over the last couple of days?
Yeah, so what's happening is that we have now over 5,500 migrants, mostly from Central America, who are in Tijuana. They're mostly camped out at a sports complex there in Tijuana. And the vast majority of them have indicated that they want to request asylum. They want to do what the U.S. government has asked them to do and present themselves at the port of entry there, which is the San Ysidro port of entry between Tijuana and San Diego, to request asylum. But the problem is, for all of this that we've heard about, the National Guard heading to the border, the military, active duty heading down to the border, all these extra Border Patrol agents that have been going down to protect against illegal entries, the administration hasn't made any corresponding moves to improve or increase the number of asylum applications that they can process. And right now at San Ysidro, that stands at about 100 a day. So the protest started with them going up to the border, trying to protest how slow that process is moving, and that's where things started escalating. Some groups tried to scale the fence, and CBP personnel on the other side started deploying tear gas. In a couple of cases, CBP said this morning that their agents had rocks thrown at them, at least four cases of that. No serious injuries reported. The CBP agents were wearing, you know, pretty much riot gear in that area, so there weren't any major injuries, but they said that was in response to that. All that basically gives you a sense of just how tense things are at that port of entry right now.
So we have this long process of applying for asylum. As you said, about 100 a day they could handle, thousands of people waiting to apply. So that means people are maybe settling in to stay for weeks on the Tijuana side of the border. What do we know about what conditions they're living in right now?
Yeah, weeks or months, depending on how long this goes. And as more people continue reaching Tijuana, and every time you hear about the port closing, that means there were no asylum applications that day. So it could be a very long time. And what we're hearing is just an incredibly difficult situation, Tijuana. The government there has been trying to do what it can to feed these folks. Twice a day they're being fed. There are incredibly long lines to do so. A lot of advocacy groups on both sides of the border have been sending doctors, volunteers, people that have been kind of collecting, sort of picture like what you send after a natural disaster, kind of sending kits and whatever food that they can down to these folks. But with that many expected to stay for that long a time, the concern is that, you know, supplies are going to run low, funds in Tijuana are going to run low. This is a lot to ask of any city government to sort of absorb the cost of this many people for that much time. So, just today we saw in Tijuana, we saw the police deploy around that sports complex a couple of times with riot gear. Last I saw, they put everything away and started moving on. That kind of gives you an idea. They're in this for the long haul, and it's going to be an expensive and a very stressful, kind of tense situation throughout.
And as far as the asylum process itself, as I understand it, Alan, if I'm a migrant, if I come to a port of entry, a legal port of entry, I can apply for asylum status. I can also do so if I've entered illegally, right?
Correct. Under U.S. law, it's very, very clear on this point that you can apply for asylum whether or not you enter at a port of entry. We're also signed on to several international conventions that say as much. And the idea behind that is that if you're somebody who is truly fleeing persecution, who is fearing for your life, that you don't have the time to, prepare a well-organized, coordinated departure and entry into the United States. So that's always been allowed under, not always, but for about 50 years, it's been allowed under U.S. law. The Trump administration tried to issue an order to end the opportunity for asylum for those people who enter illegally. The president signed a presidential proclamation back on November 9th stating as such. It was immediately challenged in the courts, and a federal judge in California last week blocked them from doing that. So for now, yes, they can continue, whether they enter legally or illegally, they can request asylum. And yesterday, for example, with all of that chaos that we saw, about 69 immigrants were able to get across the fence. And I put the question to the CBP commissioner today, if those people request asylum, yes, the answer is yes, they will be able to go through that process and try to stay in the country that way.
Talking to Alan Gomez with the USA Today, looking at the latest on the border, the so-called caravan of migrants from Central America in Tijuana now, most of them. Alan, let's talk about what is leading people to come up here from Central America. A couple years ago now, I think we talked to you after you reported from a few different countries in Central America. Can you talk about what is leading people to make this desperate journey across Mexico into this uncertain situation at the U.S. border?
Yeah, I mean, the conditions in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, the three countries where they predominantly come from, are terrible, and specifically when it comes to security. These are Guatemala is doing a little bit better than, let's say, El Salvador. You know, we can get into, you know, we can rank them a little bit. But generally speaking, these are countries that have huge swaths of the country that are pretty much controlled by drug cartels, controlled by local gangs. All the drugs that come up from South America have to go through Central America, and so controlling those routes is paramount for all these different gangs throughout the region. And so the people who live in those areas fall victim to that. These gangs, they demand a tax on local businesses for protection. They, you know, if they see young boys that they want to be a part of their gang, if they see young girls that they want to take advantage of, they threaten the families. It is really a horrific experience. So a lot of these families are trying to flee that violence. That said, there are definitely some people who view this as an opportunity to say, hey, look, I have a better chance at a better job in the United States. So some of them are definitely getting into these caravans and trying to claim asylum. But the process eventually works. About 75% of asylum claims from Central American countries end up being denied. So that's an example that these are working. The problem is a lot of times those people don't end up being deported. So, you know, it's a very complicated from start to finish process, all of which indicates that what the country really needs right now is a broad legislative solution. We've talked about how difficult that is and how little to expect out of this Congress to come up with a nuanced, intelligent, you know, broad solution to all these different problems. But until we reach that point, I fear we're going to continue seeing these kind of things happen.
The president has raised concerns that criminals themselves are using something like the caravan to find their way in the United States. I think it was the vice president who raised concerns about Middle Eastern terrorists tagging along. What do we know about any possible, I guess, criminal elements in the caravan?
So far, it's the administration saying, take our word for it. We've been asking since Trump first started making that claim, when he warned of, quote, Middle Easterners as part of the group and criminals. Just this morning, he wrote that these are stone-cold criminals. During an interview from Mar-a-Lago over the Thanksgiving weekend, he talked about something about they, if you just talk to them, they start a fight. And so throughout all of this, we have been pressing the Department of Homeland Security and the entire Trump administration for any kind of proof of this. What they tell us is that they've identified about 500 people in this group, in this caravan, that have some kind of criminal record, but they have yet to sort of account for that, how they know that, who these people are, what their backgrounds are. And so, yeah, it's just, they keep saying it and they keep repeating it. We're just still waiting for the proof.
Is there any talk, Alan, of the U.S. and Mexico being able to conclude a complete agreement to expedite the process for asylum and maybe to send down, as you were hinting at earlier, more people to process these asylum claims?
Yeah, they're talking about it because I think on both sides they recognize that these kind of caravans, if they continue, will just continue being a strain on each country and a strain on relations throughout the region. So they have been talking about some idea of sort of formalizing a process by which migrants would wait in Mexico while their asylum cases are adjudicated. But in just a few days, on December 1st, a new administration is starting in Mexico. The new president there, López Obrador, he won his election, being the anti-Trump voice in that election, and so we're just starting to hear word that they're fighting back against this idea of the U.S. using Mexico as a sort of refugee camp for people trying to get in. So those negotiations they're ongoing, but I think they're going to be very difficult because Mexicans are generally not very, you know, they're not complete. They have sympathy for these caravan members, but they also don't want to be the place where they're going to be living for years and years as they try to get into the United States. So that's going to be a quick early test of what this new relationship between Trump and the new Mexican president is going to be. But as of right now, they're still in very heated negotiations, let's say, over what that's going to look like.
Alan, I want to wrap up by talking about coverage of this caravan as it's been going on and arriving at the border. Is this a crisis, or when we talk about it in terms of a crisis, are we overheating things more than we should be?
Well, that could be a whole show right there, but I'll very quickly, I would say that this is the largest of these caravans. They have been doing these for years as a way for these migrants to more safely traverse Mexico. It's a very dangerous journey, and they've recognized that there is safety in numbers. So from that standpoint, this is by far the largest of the caravans that we've seen in recent years. But when you put things into context, any given year, about 400,000 people are caught illegally trying to enter the country. And we're having all of this discussion over a group of 5,000 people who are trying to legally request asylum. So part of it is I think rightfully responding to a president who has mobilized, you know, an unprecedented mobilization of active duty troops to the border. That's something that absolutely needs to be covered. They're sending so many more resources and manpower down to that region, and he's trying to change U.S. laws basically on the fly, and so all of that deserves very close scrutiny and very close analysis. But at the same time, yeah, we all have to put it into context that these are 5,000 people who are trying to carry out their legal right to request asylum in this country.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Rob, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
That's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He was with us to talk about the latest at the U.S.-Mexico border after hundreds of protesters from the caravan clashed with security agents yesterday. Coming up, we'll talk about Milwaukee's efforts to settle on a new city flag, and then we'll ask you what you think a flag for your community ought to look like. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you've got your virtual shopping carts filled on this Cyber Monday, maybe think twice before clicking that final purchase button. We'll hear from a minimalist blogger who says we should rethink who and what we're gifting to make this holiday season less stressful. Right now, people in Milwaukee might have seen a new flag flying around town over the last couple of years. It features the sun rising over Lake Michigan. The flag was chosen as the People's Flag in 2016 after it won a design contest to replace the previous city flag. Earlier this month, though, the City Arts Board said it wanted a new, more inclusive competition to choose an official winner, putting the status of the city's official flag up in the air. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you were designing a flag for your community, what would it look like? What would you want people outside your city or town to know about by looking at your flag? Maybe a local landmark, an industry, tradition? If your community already has a flag, what does it look like? And if you live in Milwaukee, have you seen this new People's Flag around town? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy Janine is the president and co-founder of the online daily UrbanMilwaukee.com. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Milwaukee's old city flag has a lot going on. It hasn't gotten a lot of praise in the world of flags. Can you tell us a little bit about the old flag and why we saw this effort to replace it in this design process?
Sure. The ironic thing of all of this debate that's happening now is a similar thing played out in the 1950s, and no candidate was chosen after a design contest. But the Common Council, the legislative body for the city of Milwaukee, had an alderman at the time with design experience who said, hey, I have an idea. I will take the best elements of every flag design that was submitted and put them all into one flag. And so what Milwaukee has today is a flag that has a big grain of wheat. It has a large gear on it. It has what appears to be County Stadium. It has some smokestacks, a City Hall depiction on it. There is actually a flag within the flag to add all the layers to it. And then one of the most controversial elements, and there's not a lot of good record keeping on this, but there is an Indian and headdress on it, which is believed to depict the Milwaukee Braves, but one that everyone agrees probably should go.
Now tell us about the winner that came out of this people's flag process.
So in 2016, Steve Kotis and a group of other design-minded individuals conducted a flag design contest. They got more than 1,000 entries. And at the time, even though Mayor Barrett and Common Council President Ashanti Hamilton were both present at the unveiling of the 50 finalists, it was never put forth that, hey, this is going to certainly be the official flag. But still more than 6,000 people voted on a group of five finalists that were selected. There's a group of 50 selected by a panel of experts, and then that was whittled down to five. And then Robert Lenz, a Bayview resident, designed the winning flag, which you described before, which has a depiction, a circle in the middle, blue on the bottom that represents Lake Michigan, yellow on the top that represents the city's brewing history, and then three stripes, which represent the city's three founders and three main rivers. That flag won pretty convincingly with 6,000 votes in a design contest that was entirely unofficial, although the design contest was unveiled at City Hall.
Now, it's an unofficial flag. There's an effort in the works to maybe make it official, but the City Arts Board says, well, this private contest isn't representative. It's not official enough for us?
Yeah, the Common Council, a broad range of members of the Common Council, three of them, but representing a broad reach of the city, introduced an amendment, or not an amendment, but a proposal in July to formally adopt the flag. They were ready to kind of put their mark down, let's have a vote, let's make it a flag. Well, what happened is that got to the council's steering and rules committee, and that committee said, yeah, we're not ready to make a decision. Let's punt this over to the Arts Board. The Arts Board was no more eager to make a decision and took a number of months. They have a December 31st deadline to render an opinion. And after meeting for many hours over many meetings, they determined that the 2016 unofficial process was just not inclusive enough. A couple key points were that none of the materials were ever translated into Spanish or any other languages, and then most of the outreach took place online. They didn't feel like that was an inclusive way to reach the whole community. So their recommendation back to the council now is to essentially start over. Not that the current flag, the current people's flag, could ever it is eligible to win in this contest, but that a new process should take place that is more inclusive and one that could cost over $100,000 to execute.
Before I let you go, Jeremy, would you or have you flown this flag, the new one?
It is quite prevalent in Milwaukee. My wife is quite the fan, so it hangs outside our house. But I am agnostic on the process because I want it to be inclusive.
Jeremy, thank you so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to our callers at 800-642-1234. We want to know, wherever you are, what should be on a flag that would represent your community? An industry, a tradition, a landmark, you name it. Or if you're in the Milwaukee area, what do you think of this this new flag? Do you want to see it be the official one? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to Jordan now in Stevens Point. Jordan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, Jordan?
So the study of flags is called vexillology, and it is based off the Latin word for flag or battle standard. And there is actually a North American Vexillological Association.
Okay.
One of them, a member by the name of Ted Kay, came out with a principle called good flag, bad flag. And it has five basic points to making a good flag. And there are things like keep it simple so that even children can draw it from memory, not having lettering or seals, only using a couple different colors, and using meaningful symbolism. And it's a really cool way to make sure that your flag is easily identifiable, but still means things.
And have you, it sounds like you're a flag person yourself, Jordan, have you applied those principles to these two different Milwaukee-designed flags by any chance?
Oh, yeah. The first Milwaukee flag is awful. Actually, he has a YouTube video on it, and he cites the Milwaukee flag and compares it to the Chicago flag and saying that the Milwaukee flag violates all five of these principles, whereas the Chicago flag follows all of them beautifully.
And have you've seen the new Milwaukee People's flag? Does that fit with the principles better?
Yes, it does. It only uses a couple of different colors. It's definitely simple and easy for children to draw. It's still distinctive and related without being too over the top.
Well, Jordan, nobody else called in about what they'd want in their local flag. If you can hang with us for a minute, since you're a flag person, do you have a flag, an official flag there in Point?
I'm not familiar with it, but I think the city's seal is a white background with a green evergreen tree on it, because Stevens Point is the gateway to the Pineries. So, again, it only has two colors, only has one item on it, so it meets the principles pretty well.
Now, is it hard to come up with a simple design in what probably has to be a bureaucratic process, right? Like we were hearing in Milwaukee, you need to get buy-in from the community, you have to go through channels, and more people might mean you want to put more stuff on a flag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely especially when it's put to a vote or you're trying to make as many people happy as possible, that's going to be really difficult. But flag design goes all the way back to the Middle Ages when you were trying to determine if Duke Sir So-and-so is a friend of mine and Earl Sir So-and-so is an enemy of mine. How do I tell that when I can't actually see their face? So instant recognizability is something that's really important with battlefield flags.
Fantastic. Jordan, thanks for calling in and sharing vexillological knowledge with us today.
You got it. Bingo.
All right. Hey, we've been talking about flags. Thanks to Jordan for calling in with his flag expertise. Also, Jeremy Janine from UrbanMilwaukee.com talking about the Milwaukee flag design debate. If you have thoughts on a flag for your city or town, you can still email us, ideas@WPR.org, or send us a picture of your flag or local seal. Love to check it out. Coming up after the news, nearly 7 in 10 Americans said they'd prefer to skip exchanging gifts this holiday season if their family and friends agree to it. We'll talk to a blogger who says we can plan ahead to make our holiday seasons more meaningful and less about stressing over presents and other traditions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Holiday traditions can be a lot of fun. Many of us like munching on Christmas cookies and exchanging gifts with friends and family, but there sometimes comes a time when it feels like you might have outgrown a tradition. Or maybe like the Griswold family in this clip from the movie Holiday Vacation, you're looking for the authentic experience in all the wrong places.
Dad, didn't they invent Christmas tree lots so people wouldn't have to drive all the way out to nowhere and waste a whole Saturday?
They invented them, Russ, because people forgot how to have a fun, old-fashioned family Christmas and are satisfied with scrawny, dead, overpriced trees that have no special meaning.
My toes are numb.
You see, kids, this is what our forefathers did.
I can't feel my leg.
They walked out into the woods, they picked out that special tree, and they cut it down with their bare hands.
Feeling pressure to spend money, feeling stressed about finding the right gifts, rushing to get all the stuff done to have the perfect holiday, our next guest says we can simplify and leave those stressful feelings behind. Rachel Jones is the Joyful Space Specialist. She blogs and provides resources for people looking to reduce clutter from their lives. She wrote A Minimalist Guide to the Holidays, which you can find at nourishingminimalism.com. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, I know you've looked at minimalism and cutting back in a lot of parts of your life. What led you to start looking at the holidays as a way to maybe cut back some of that physical and, I guess, emotional and logistical clutter?
You know, it all kind of ties together because with minimalism, I was looking for a way to gain some control of my life. I felt very chaotic, And so the holidays were very similar in that they, I just had this expectation of myself. And I think most moms do. We have this super mom mentality where we need to live up to a certain standard, and we really require a lot of ourselves. So simplifying the holidays made sense in that.
And when it comes to a holiday tradition, I think, as I've discovered with my family in some cases, a lot of times there's that thing, you've always done it, everybody expects it. And when you start asking around, people aren't really that into it anymore. How do you start to have that conversation about, okay, what do we like to do? What do we do because we feel like we're supposed to do it?
Yeah, I recommend that families sit down together and just start it off and just kind of brain dump with what are the things that we do every year and what are our favorites, and highlight those favorites and figure out which one everyone really enjoys. And I think the best thing is to just pick, you know, say we can only do a certain amount of things. So how about we pick five and just focus on getting those five done and let the rest go this year.
Now, that can involve a tough thing sometimes, saying no to someone. How can we tactfully and politely decline that sixth event that crosses the threshold?
It is very challenging. So I like to be honest and just practice honesty with everything. But you can also just say, let your no be no, and you don't have to explain. You don't have to feel guilty about it. I do recommend that when you decide on those particular traditions, that you write them on the calendar, you make time for them with your family, and you let all the kids know and everyone know that this is the time we're going to do it, and you hold to it like an appointment. So when someone invites you to something and you have a family event on that day, you are free to say, no, I'm sorry, I already have that time filled. And a lot of it is just learning to say no without having to explain.
One thing I see a lot more is people being more flexible about when the holiday celebration happens. When I was a kid, I remember one family, it was Christmas Eve. The other family, it was Christmas Day. And now, you know, people move around the country. Sometimes it's the weekend before or the weekend after, or it's New Year's. Are you seeing people get more flexible about when the family celebration, say, happens?
Yes, I've seen that as well, which is very nice. And then, you know, some families even have moved it out into January or the 1st of January, which makes things much easier to work around.
Talking to Rachel Jones about her Minimalist Guide to the Holidays. You can find it at her website, nourishingminimalism.com. Rachel, let's talk about the cleaning and decorating. That's one of the things you write about is, okay, part of the stress here is, especially for hosting a thing, we want the house to look awesome, immaculate, beautifully decorated. How can we do something cool without adding to the stress?
That's very true. We hold ourselves to a very high standard, especially with in-laws coming over. So I recommend just focusing on the main parts of the living area and just keeping them settling, I guess, settling to keep them just a regular maintenance. So you keep your dishes done and your counters clean and just let the rest go. It's okay.
And then how about meal planning?
Meal planning, yes. Give yourself a break. It's okay to cut corners, and it's okay to buy pre-made things. You don't have to make everything from scratch. And the important thing is the relationships that you have and getting together with your family.
Right. It seems like the big you're worried about is, you know, we have good relationships, hopefully, with family and friends, but there can be tension there. And you want to not add to the tension because we're worried about, is the turkey going to be done? Are the handmade decorations adhering to the wall properly? That kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And so since you've come out with this minimalist guide, are you hearing this from a lot of people like, I've been overstressed at the holidays, too?
Yes, we, particularly moms, have a standard, and we expect so much of ourselves. So, you know, the the outside decorations, the inside decorations, and the cleanliness and the perfect food. And it's okay to just accept who you are and what you're capable of and learn to be comfortable with that.
And how about people might feel a little element of guilt if you stop doing tradition X, if you stop making food Y, that's been the thing. How do we overcome maybe that initial guilt about that change?
You know, it's interesting. When I stopped doing Christmas cards, I felt that guilt. But I realized that no one noticed. It was just... So keep that in mind. It's what we expect of ourselves and not everybody else.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with that one. Now, it's Cyber Monday, so we probably shouldn't get through this all without talking about a big thing at holiday season, the gifts. How do you take a minimalist approach to gift giving?
I recommend just talking about it. And depending on the people in your family, this might just be the beginning of a conversation. It might take several years to get a more simplified gift-giving tradition. But start the conversation and talk about the things that you have in your home, particularly with kids. If people are wanting to give your kids a lot of gifts, that's usually what I hear about is, you know, how do I stop this influx of toys? And so you start the conversation, and I would say the best way to start is to say, I have some fear in telling you this, but this is what's going on in our family life. We don't have room for these toys. The kids have too many that they're kind of overwhelmed. So we'd like to focus on activities or experiences, and they can be wonderful, you know, tickets to baseball games and different sporting events or theaters or lessons. There's so many varieties of more consumable type gifts and not things that will clutter up your home.
Have you run into pushback on that when you've talked to people? Because some people want to have a thing that they've wrapped and they hand to the kid.
Yes. Grandparents usually struggle with that, which is why I say this might be the beginning of a conversation. It might take years. And there's sometimes where there's people that just will not. They're going to give a gift no matter what you say. And you know, you don't want this to ruin relationships. So, you know, be gracious, let the kids open it, let them play with it, and don't feel guilty about donating it in a month.
We're talking to Rachel Jones. She blogs about minimalism and reducing clutter at nourishingminimalism.com. She's helping us simplify our holidays in part to make them less stressful. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your holiday traditions, maybe with family or friends, to make something that feels more meaningful and maybe less stressful? Have you done something to take some of the stress out of your holiday events? How about gift giving? What do you think about when giving gifts, receiving gifts? Have you canceled a gift exchange of some kind to make it simpler and make sure people don't end up with stuff they don't want? Call 800-642-1234. Or if there's a holiday tradition, they're like, yeah, we're going to stick with this. We love this thing. I'd love to hear about that too. Call 800-642-1234. You can also post, by the way, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Rachel Jones. She's a minimalist and a blogger at nourishingminimalism.com. She wrote a minimalist guide to the holidays. You can find that at her website. She's joining us to talk about making the holiday season a bit less stressful for you, maybe by rethinking, reinventing some of the traditions from year to year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do your holiday traditions stress you out? Have you tried to give fewer gifts or maybe different kinds of gifts in the past year? Have you changed a tradition to make it work better for you, your family, your friends? Or is there one you love and you stick with? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls now, Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi there.
Hi. You know, I think it's a shame that people are getting rid of the traditions nowadays. I love Christmas. I have a great time. I love buying stuff for people. I don't care if I get anything back or not, but I always do. Almost always. But I was thinking about Halloween as an example. My son his in-laws, they don't celebrate any holidays anymore, or they didn't. And he's kind of reintroduced holidays to them. And some of them in their family never experienced before. And they love the cooking and the carving pumpkins and things. And I think a lot of people are just losing out on this stuff. Everybody's too worried about keeping up with the Joneses. And the holidays are one of the few things that people can actually share together every year.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. And Rachel, you're not anti-tradition necessarily, but it sounds like Dave and his son have found particular parts of the traditions, the things that are like, and are sharing them with people and kind of making them new traditions.
I think that's wonderful. Traditions are very important. We have several kind of elaborate traditions in our family, and those are just ones that we've picked and we've let go of the traditions that stress me out, the cookie exchange and the decorating quite as much and outside decorating, things like that. So definitely they're very important.
And Rachel, have you found that decluttering the tradition load there, stopping those things you were just talking about, makes the stuff that you do still do or that you've started to do more fun and meaningful?
I think it does. It makes it easier to accomplish it. So, for example, we just went yesterday and we drove up into the mountains and cut down a Christmas tree. And having a minimalist home means it's very easy to keep order, keep clean. And so just taking off for a day and getting a tree and coming home, there's very little stress involved in that.
Dave, thanks again for the call. Sandy is with us now in Mineral Point. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. So several years ago, instead of exchanging gifts, my sisters and I decided that we would just love each other for another year.
All right. And do you, like, have you done something? Like, do you get together for an activity or write a letter? How do you,
no,
do you mark that in a certain way?
We just, many years ago, just said, you know, we have enough stuff. If we need anything, we can buy it. Rather, you know, we'll just love each other for another year.
Sounds fantastic, Sandy. Thanks so much for the call. And Rachel, we talked about giving gifts to kids in particular. Sandy's probably on board with a lot of grown-ups of like, hey, maybe we can stop that gift exchange now.
Yeah, I think Sandy has a point. The idea of giving a gift is that personal connection and being able to show love to each other. And so, yes, as adults, it's much easier. And as kids, we have to be, or for our kids, we have to be a little more creative in how can we show them that we love them without adding clutter.
Thanks for that call, Sandy. We're talking to Rachel Jones. She's the Joyful Space Specialist. We're talking about her Minimalist Guide to the Holidays. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed a tradition by default or on purpose? Do you find a lot of the holiday stuff stressful? What are your favorite parts of holiday traditions this time of year? What do you want to focus on? And what have you done when it comes to exchanging gifts? 800-642-1234 is the number. Dan is with us now in De Pere. Dan, hello.
Yeah, hi. I love Christmas, and I don't mind buying stuff for Christmas, but I find that if you purchase stuff that people like to do, for instance, movie tickets, theater tickets, football tickets, spa tickets, whatever their passion is, you know, give them something to do, help them save some money, and they almost never return that.
Gotcha. And so, Dan, you know whatever so-and-so cousin X loves movies, you get not like a specific date and time. You just get a gift certificate for movie tickets, say?
Yeah, you could go out and buy like a $50 package. They can use it whenever they want. Or maybe they want to see The Lion King. You got to do a little bit of homework. You know, you got to figure out what their passion is. If it's sports, buy them sports tickets. If it's theater, buy them theater tickets. And they almost always appreciate that.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. And Rachel, I like that Dan does some homework because you don't want to commit to somebody to going to an event that maybe they're a little peshy about.
Absolutely. I think that's the most important thing when you're looking for clutter-free gift ideas, because they are mostly experiences, and you do need to know who you're buying the gift for and what they're interested in.
Do you have ideas, Rachel, similar to his maybe, or other ones that you've come up with for more experienced type of gifts?
Yes, because I deal with a lot of moms and children's in my niche, it's the like zoo memberships, science museums, kids museums, and more things, especially if it's grandparents, if they will do the activity with the child, like take the child to the ballpark for a baseball game, that's even better than just the tickets. You know, we all want to share those experiences with people we love.
Thanks again for that call. Rachel, you were touching on this earlier. Are you hearing from, I imagine you hear back from a lot of parents, are you hearing from a lot of people that, yeah, this time of year really is stressful and they don't know where to start?
Definitely. I think because there's so much, you know, there's the cards and the shopping and the gifts, and it's very, very challenging to pick out what it is. We'll simplify it if we just leave that.
Let's go to another call. There's Dave in Hebron. Dave, hi.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to say what we do for Christmas. We have a large family, so every year one of the children, start with the youngest, work with the oldest, one of them has a Christmas event, and we all get together for a nice meal, and then the highlight of the whole thing is the white elephant gift. And they're really fun. And the family seems to appreciate them. And for gift, what we do, and of course it isn't handled at this party, of course, is we make gifts for the children. And even though the gifts don't cost us hardly a cent, we work for the whole year making them because we have to make 50 of them, whatever we're going to decide to make. And I tell you, these children appreciate them and they keep them. You go buy them a $25 gift, and in a week it's gone.
And Dave, I got to ask, do you have fun making these gifts?
Do we have fun making them?
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of fun. We start, in fact, we will be starting for next Christmas right after this Christmas is over.
All right, you in the North Pole too, Dave. Thanks so much for calling in and sharing that. I love that. So you can take, Rachel, maybe a craft or hobby that you love anyway and make it part of the holiday tradition.
Yes, I think that's wonderful. It comes down to what's really important to your family and what does your family really enjoy.
Thanks for that call, Dave. And Rachel, what's one of the easiest but maybe biggest changes you've made around the holiday season that could be a good first step for people listening right now?
You know, I would have to say the first one I did was to not send out Christmas cards anymore because I had you know, about 400 people that I would send Christmas cards to. So that reduced so much stress without having to address all of them and write a Christmas letter and get them mailed and everything.
And you mentioned earlier you didn't hear a big outcry from the public when you stopped doing that.
No, not one person.
And is there something, even after all of the thought you've put into this and the change you've made, is there something that still stresses even you out come holiday season?
It does. One of our traditions is to make gingerbread houses, and that's something that our kids really love. And so one year I bought a boxed set where it's, you know, everything's pre-made. And they're like, oh, Mom, this is just not the same. And so the day that I have to make gingerbread houses is a bit stressful for me, but I've decided that it's important enough for our family that I'm willing to do that.
We'll leave it there for now. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Rachel Jones is the Joyful Space Specialist. She blogs and provides resources for people looking to reduce clutter from their lives. She wrote this guide. It's called A Minimalist Guide to the Holidays. You can find that at her website. It's called nourishingminimalism.com. Now, we still have time to hear your stories. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. A couple of questions for you. Have you changed one of your holiday traditions in part because you found out nobody liked it in the first place or because it was stressful? Have you invented something new for friends and family that you've come to enjoy? And do you still send out holiday cards? Do you have fun? Do you enjoy doing that? post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Quick gingerbread house story. A neighbor invited us along. This is years back. Kids were younger. To one of these maker spaces to make gingerbread houses with the CAD CAM laser cutter. So they'd made a program and they had these big sheets of baked gingerbread. And then they put the gingerbread under the cutter and then they fired up the laser and it boom, 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 cut out. It was cool. The smell of charred gingerbread along the laser line was a little bit much, though. Another big holiday tradition is the holiday movie. And what makes a Thanksgiving movie a Thanksgiving movie, a Christmas movie a Christmas movie? Bill Martins has seen like six movies. He's in here now, producer Bill Martins. Hey.
Hi there.
Now, you have a Thanksgiving tradition.
We did, we watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles on Thanksgiving Eve.
Right, and there's a connection there. It's not a random movie.
No, it is. It takes place around Thanksgiving. It stars Steve Martin and John Candy. They're both stranded in New York. They're trying to get back home to Chicago for Thanksgiving.
All right, let's give a little listen. The Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, things go wrong in all forms of transportation. Here's after a big problem with the car.
Now, you got no outside mirror.
No, we lost that.
You have no functioning gauges.
No, not a one. However, the radio still works. Funny as that may seem, with all this mess, that the radio is the only thing that's really working good, and it's as clear as a bell. Don't ask me how.
That's one of my favorite scenes in that whole movie. It's awesome.
It's a fun movie, and you watch it every Thanksgiving?
Yep.
And you also got a little ahead of the season,
well, Thanksgiving
too.
Eve, I should say. Thanksgiving Eve. Night, we watched Home Alone.
Right, to get in the Christmas spirit, because that's
course.
A movie that takes place over Christmas.
It is, yep.
And, of course, the common theme of the two movies, Mr. John
Candy.
The late John
exactly.
Candy.
Yeah, of course. He makes every movie better.
Yeah, you'll watch anything with John Candy in it.
I will, including Strange Brew and... No, wait.
Is he in Strange Brew? We've talked about this before. Well, right,
wait,
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Was he? Yeah.
Was he?
We'll have to go back and look at IMDb. Do you have another big Christmas movie you want to watch?
Home Alone 2. Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Put the cookie down?
Now.
All right. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.